welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Welcome to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. We're going to change pace a little bit today. The Book of Five Rings is a classic text on strategy and combat that was written by the legendary samurai Miyamoto Musashi nearly 400 years ago. And today, I'm joined by Mark Morales to talk about how the wisdom contained in this book is still relevant for self-protection today. Now, Mark is a two-time recipient of the LAPD Medal of Valor after a long and well-rewarded and well-awarded career with the LAPD. He's also a threat assessment and personal protection practitioner with his own security firm, and he's a high-ranking martial artist in several styles. He combines an incredible personal experience in frontline self-protection with classical training and a deep appreciation for written works on life, death, and combat. So please enjoy this conversation, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Self-Protection, with Mark Morales. I'm joined here on the Managing Violence Podcast once again by Mark Morales. Mark, great to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show. And right off the bat, I was going through, I guess, the last few months of, listening to different people you had on. And it is such a wealth of incredible knowledge out there. Just so many smart, talented people. And I enjoy it. It makes me want to be not only a better martial artist and security practitioner, inspires me to be a better person, because a lot of these people that you've had on your podcast, they are incredibly smart, talented people.
Yeah, it's been an incredible journey for me to interview so many world leaders, thought leaders, people that have written the books that shaped my career, and certainly have had the experiences to share. So, and you're one of those people. So, Mark, thank you very much. And we've gone at length through your background in the last episode that we talked about. But for those that perhaps don't have the appetite to go back and listen to that episode, can you give us sort of the 1 minute snapshot of who Mark Morales is and your career that's led you to this point? And then we'll talk about the actual topic.
Yes. I was a athlete that participated in wrestling and in judo, but more in wrestling. And once that was coming to an end, I did an enlistment in the Marine Corps. And then I served for 28 years with the Los Angeles Police Department out in patrol assignments or things that worked out of a patrol division, being on the tip of the spear. So in that, I dealt with the worst of the worst on a daily basis. And that helped me to define myself as a martial artist and a protector. And I know today we're going to talk about Miyamoto Musashi and his writings and who he was as a samurai and a duelist, really impacted my life. And I just, like one of the main points is, that he was a warrior and a scholar. And I've tried to, people are more aware probably of my policing exploits, but, I'm a guy that's hit the books pretty hard too. And I would say that Musashi's been my major inspiration for that.
Yeah, look, that's one of the things I found most interesting talking to you the first time, was that you kind of blended a lot of the worlds that we dabble in that you had that combat sport initiation and desire to compete and all those things that I definitely resonate with. Then you went into policing and had a very long and highly regarded and rewarded career. You've been very modest about your exploits. You can Google Mark Morales if you want to see the nature of his career in the LAPD, and then went on to start a security business or a protection and investigations business, which is, I think, Yeah, it just goes to show the character and who you are and what makes you up, in that you could quite easily retire on a pension and go off and do something else, and instead you're still back in the battlefront, or at least in terms of keeping people safe. But also the fact that you've written books and you've been a scholar, and that's why after our last conversation, we're talking about what we could talk about for a second one. And I thought, rather than getting into the nitty gritty and the practical of hand fighting and arrest techniques and things that I know you've written about and you're extensively experienced about, let's sort of take a back step. And this is a bit of, I guess, just letting my inner nerd out a little bit. And let's talk about Musashi, because I know you and I are both big fans of Musashi's work and his writings and the applicability and practicality of the writings that are, you know, what, 400 plus years old now, and yet they still apply in everyday life. So we floated this idea, let's do a conversation about Musashi and see where it goes. So I tasked Mark, who is a studious, likes to prepare for things. I said, hey, come up with a couple of key points you think are relevant from the Book of Five Rings and also Dakaido, and how do we go, what would apply from that in the modern world, from your policing experience, from your protective security experience, and from your experience on the front lines. So that's kind of the outline for this episode. Where it goes, I don't know. Mark and I are kind of kindred spirits. We'll probably float around all over the place, but let's start off at the very beginning. One of the notes you sent me was about the ground book, and I think this is probably a great place to start the conversation, because, well, it's always good to have your grounding, right? That's a bit of a dad joke, but it works. So just talking about strategy. So let's unpack what is the ground book and how does that apply to you and your experience and so on.
So if you're not familiar with the Book of Five Rings, the ground book, or the earth book, is the opening chapter of a five chapter summary. Would be the ground book, the water book, the fire book, the wind book, and the void book. And so Musashi wrote this very close to his death. One of the things, if you look at like Musashi's writings, he did a lot of writing over the course of his life, and a lot of it was like refined over time. And so this basically culminates, his combat style. So there's a few seminal texts, and it'd be the Book of Five Rings, the Sun Tzu Art of War, Machiavelli's Art of War, there's some very seminal texts, but first and foremost, the Book of Five Rings is probably the most related to strategy, and the ground book really lays it out in the beginning, because the central theme is outlined in the first sentence, which states strategy is the craft of the warrior. And it delves into what we're just talking about, the pen and the sword, and that a warrior, and this is the writings of Musashi coming out, that a writer had to have both. You had to be a scholar and you had to have the combat skills. The thing about the Book of Five Rings is it really is written towards the reader and combat. It's not like a philosophical way out there. It's, in some of the other books, they get right into tactics of what to do and not what to do in swordsmanship, kenjutsu. But like what really resonates to me, and of course we're reading these texts because we're still getting things out of them that are making us better human beings and professionals and martial artists. And one of the hot topics going around today is hard skills and soft skills, right? And when we talk about the pen and the sword, hard skills, of course, those are our tactical skills, firearms training, arrest and control, movement and protection details, and things that we're doing physically. Soft skills, which there's a real movement to refine, and the tactical butler, concierge service, these are all things that are very much talked about within the private security industry in particular to protection or bodyguarding, if you will. And in the modern, I see a lot of people talking about soft skills. And this is what I want to pick your brain about, Joe, is the reality is there's so much push today for soft skills, but you got to have those hard skills in your back pocket, because if something goes awry, you've got to have that backup plan. And the more you're squared away tactically, the more you can keep talking or you know that you have a very solid tactical background and you can handle yourself. The more you're able to communicate and not probably resort to, a physical situation, if you will.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And if I think about when I started really practicing, say, verbal skills, de-escalation skills, and the art of influence, trying to talk people into doing something they didn't want to do, or ideally get them to do the thing and think it was their idea, even though it was my idea. But that whole art, the only reason I was able to play with that and had enough leeway to be able to, I guess, enter the lab and to try different techniques and try different approaches and to do it real time with a live aggressive person in front of me, was that I knew I had the backing of the physical skills, so that if I failed, which when you're learning and trying something new, you will fail on a regular basis, that when it didn't go well, I knew I was still going to be safe, and I knew I was still able to control that situation if it escalated, and sort of chalk that one up to experience. If you don't have that backing, that's when I think we end up when either people get hurt because they talk too long, or they're not looking at the signs well enough, or they panic and they say the wrong things and their fear starts to creep in, which prevents them from being able to communicate well. It also shuts down their peripheral vision. It can switch off their situational awareness because they are concerned that if this goes wrong, I'm in trouble. And I think this. And we could go on a massive tangent here, and I'll try to rein it in. But I do think that we see people overreact to potential danger or low-level danger because they're concerned that they don't have the skills to be able to manage it if it escalates. And therefore, I think we see, especially in policing, not just in the US, not just in Australia, but everywhere, we see that when the standards of training are lower, we have an overreaction and disproportionate use of force. Because there's a heavy reliance on using the tools, because the only thing I can trust 100% in theory is the stuff that's on my belt. If I know I've got the skills to be able to manage the situation without those tools, then I have a little bit more time. I can take a little bit more time. I can try my verbal techniques. I can have confidence in my arrest techniques, and then I can go to the tools if I absolutely need them. But I think to your point, if you don't have confidence in those hard skills, it's really hard to fully invest in using the soft skills.
And that's an experience thing. I hate to use a movie analogy, but I saw the movie Colors. Remember the movie Colors from the 80s with Sean Penn and Robert Duvall? Later in the 90s, I ended up working that same unit called CRASH, Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, which was the gang unit. And I, you know, when I was young, I saw the movie and I was like, hey, McGavin, he's out there and he's doing, the hardcore work, jacking up the gangsters and whatnot. Then I saw that movie maybe about 15 years later. And it was like, oh, you know what? Hodges, the training officer, you know what? He's got a level head and he's trying to reel in the young guy. And, I thought at that point, like I had realized the whole movie. And then I saw the movie right before I retired about 5 years ago. And there's a scene in the movie that kind of encapsulates the whole point in my opinion of a three-decade police career, is they're having an argument. And Hodges says to McGavin, hey, do you think that we win and they lose, or they lose and we win? Like, nobody wins out here, but you can show up every day and you can be a professional, and that's all you can do. And man, that hit me intellectually like a ton of bricks. And here's me probably seeing this movie several times over the course of maybe close to 30 years, and it hit me at the end, like, at the end of the day, right, all you can do is be a professional. And I think that's where Musashi like gets to, because not only like he had such like an extensive career in combat, and then basically began to intellectualize it, and he gave some great foundations. And here, you know, after like soft skills, one of the genius things that he did is compared the way, or the way of Kenjutsu and his art of swordsmanship to the master carpenter, and that a carpenter uses various tools to do a job and whatnot, but they have a mastery. And then on top of it, which genius in the earth, the ground book, is that then he begins to discuss different types of wood and lumber that are used. And, you know, on the front of the building, you'd use this because it looks good. And on the interior, you would use this, and maybe some wood has some knots. And he's putting together this whole construction plan. And as I was preparing for this, I said, this guy was the grandfather of the public relations department and the human resources department within his organization, because, you know, that's what we do when we build a team in security. Like, a wise supervisor once told me, like, it's like a baseball team. Some people play the outfield, some people play the infield. You know, some guys are fast, they're batting first, you know, in American baseball. Some people, they're pitching, some people are catching. There's all different spots, and people have to be placed where they're good at to form a team. And Musashi did a very good job with his, you know, his targeted audience to use not only the master builders, but using the example of both the physical people and the materials used to build a building. And that really resonates to me as a as a reader, you know, and it's purely based on his experience.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really interesting points to take out of that about knowing what tools you have, what resources you have, and utilizing them to the best of your ability. Because, I'm part of a lot of executive protection groups on different social media. Even though I haven't been operational for a long time, but I like to stay connected with the community. And one of the things that I find kind of interesting is majority of the groups are US based, so most of the members are American. And when I see people that have to go into environments where they can't carry a firearm, and all of a sudden they're panicking because they don't know what to do without the firearm. And it's like, well, that's kind of bread and butter for us. Like, we never get to carry a firearm on protection details.
Right.
But it's just the idea of like knowing what resources you have and how you're going to be able to manage a threat with the resources that you have. And if we tie that back to, I guess, like everyday life for the mum and dad listener out there that's listening to this. Like, your resources, your ability to respond, your skills you're going to have, the environment you're going to be in is going to change constantly. So if you, like, your ability to be able to deal with a aggressive situation when you're on your own might be different if you've got three toddlers with you, right? Your ability to run is going to be pretty much zero. You're going to be compromised, right? So if you've got one strategy, it's not going to work, right? You have to be able to think on the fly, think about what's the best case scenario in this situation, because my 3-year-old is not suddenly going to be able to sprint, and I can't carry that many children at one time and get away. Like, so I'm going to have to manage the situation, use bystanders, and also you become a much more sympathetic figure when you've got children with you, so maybe you can get more bystander assistance. Like, there's all these different bits and pieces about knowing your resources that you have. It's different securing your home versus securing a hotel room versus securing an Airbnb when you're on holidays. Right? And we're recording this at Christmas time. If you're watching the video, you can see the beautiful tree behind Mark. Right? There's a lot of people that are traveling. They're in areas where they don't know the neighborhood that well. Maybe they're in an Airbnb they've never been in before, and they don't know who the neighbors are. There's all these kinds of bits and pieces that, when we think about how we prevent violence, it's not just about how good you are at punching, kicking, and throwing and choking. It's about how you understand the soft skills, the awareness, the resources you have available to you. And I think probably just the final point I want to make on strategy before we move on to the next book, was that one of the things that I used to find working in sort of frontline security teams was that just simply like strategy can be a really big thing, right? You can go really deep in the weeds on strategy. Sometimes knowing why what you're trying to achieve is a big thing. And as you mentioned with the movie, like you see different perspectives with your experience, but just knowing what you're actually trying to achieve. The number of times I've been part of a situation where one person's trying to achieve one thing, the other person on the team is trying to get out of there, and the other person's trying to perform an arrest and all that. If we just were at least aligned on what it is we're actually trying to achieve, we might have had some success. But we're kind of fighting each other at the same time. Where, you know, one person's trying to do a takedown, one person's trying to do a wall-based arrest, one person's trying to flee. That three-man team is not very effective in that moment. So, yeah, even just the basics of strategy are important, of being aligned on objectives.
Yeah, what you're talking about is context. Let me share a story with you that happened to me about 20 years ago. So in my policing career, in a place like Los Angeles, being with the LAPD, we were engaged in daily operations where we dealt with the worst of the worst. And some of those situations ended up in deadly force encounters, horrific shootouts, or it'd be, going through doors at hotel rooms or, you know, looking for bad guys. And this is what we did every day. And we went in there with tactical planning, a lot of training, good group of people, some of the best men and women I've ever encountered. And we were out putting the work in. Well, one day, and I'm not going to get into the whole backstory, but I was off duty and I was involved in recapping some administrative stuff. And I decided to stop by to grab a bottle of wine from a liquor store in the North Hollywood area of Los Angeles. And I walked in and I was preoccupied, right? And I'm a guy that's always thinking tactics, always has my gun with him. You know, you're a police officer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But I left my gun in the glove box of my car because I figured I was on my way home. I wanted to be more comfortable driving. And I never put my gun back on. I entered this liquor store. And when I walked in, I looked around and I didn't see anybody, but I was preoccupied. That should have been a clue to me. And so I walked down the aisle. And I sensed a figure behind me. And I turned around, and it was a guy with a gun pointed right at me. And he said, "Come with me, and I won't hurt you." And I looked around, and this is not an unusual situation in Los Angeles. And just about a couple years before, the same situation happened to an officer who didn't have his gun. They found his police ID, and they executed him. So this quickly went through my head, like, hey, this is a man with a gun here, but there's more of them. They've obviously taken everybody out of sight, and they sent this guy out to get me. And so I was like, hey, I'm going to be dead if I go along with the situation. So I look at him. He looks at me. I do a quick scan. I see a brick wall with a door in the far corner. So I literally do a Fallsbury flop into the next aisle. I go airborne, and now we're at the end of aisles. And so I'm running, and he's paralleling me, but we're at the end of aisles. And I get to the back door, and I turn to face it and get through it, and I realize it's just a brick wall protruding. And I'm like, hey. A lot of my training came back to me, the will to survive. And I said, hey, you can take a gunshot wound. You can survive a bullet. You've got to get out of here, even if you start shooting. So I began to run, and I remember saying, I wish I had a weapon. And as soon as that, I pulled a champagne bottle off a wall as I was running. And now I'm like, hey, I'm going to meet this guy at the front door. It's going to be shots fired there. So as I turned the corner to come down, and I see the suspect there, he turns to face me, and this really heavy set guy in a red shirt walks in and sets off like the bing, you know, the front door alarm, and the suspect turns for a minute. They look at the guy in the red shirt. The guy in the red shirt sees him with the gun, gets out. And by that time, by the time the suspect turned around, I was colliding with him to run him over. And I literally ran him over. And as I ran out, my car was there. And I was like, there's a 7-Eleven kitty corner. And I said, I'm not going to be able to get to my gun. These guys are going to come out shooting. I ran kitty corner. And so I jumped over the counter and I'm like, you know, like, LAPD, I need your phone. This is a little bit before like the smartphone. And I put in a 911 call, of course, being Los Angeles, it rang 37 times. I'm exaggerating, but they did not pick up. And then the RTO, the radio transmission, or the EBO, the EBO is a 911 operator, gets on like, what's your issue? And I said, hey, off-duty LAPD, there's a takeover robbery at this liquor store. Here's the streets. And literally, you know, when that call goes out, officer needs help, three police stations from LAPD cleared out, right? And as I looked across the street, the suspect came out with a gun. Two others came out with AK-47s. And they jumped into a pickup truck. And so what had happened is 10 minutes before I'd walked in, they did a takeover robbery. They took everyone to the safe. They proned them out at gunpoint. And they took everybody's wallets. They got in the safe and they got 30 grand. And then this crew ended up doing 40 more robberies before they were captured a year later. Same style of just aggressive, you know, takeover robberies. And I was lucky to survive. If I had my gun and began to shoot it out earlier, I might not have made it. You know, somebody would have come out with a AK-47 and I would have been engaged in that. I like to think I would have made it. Later, when they showed me the video and they were doing the investigation, the captain said, hey, if you ever get a chance to do this over again, don't do this over again, because you're not going to make it. But in your context question, what if I would have been there with my kids? You know, I mean, I couldn't have put up that type of acrobatics and aggressiveness, and I'd have been there with my kids. It would have been a different type of circumstance. And that's not to say I wouldn't have made a move, but, you know, like you and me, we're not going to get our kids injured in such situations. We'll do everything not to do that, right? So sometimes you can have the tactical ability and whatnot, but you just can't react to it based on the situation. But that was a hairy story, man. I'm not doing that one over again.
That's a great story.
I got a good question for you, though.
Yeah, please.
So, you know, we're kind of, I'm not like a huge social media guy, and that's maybe none of your listeners out there, they're like, who's Mark Bareilles? Well, I'm a doer and I've done a lot of stuff, but I'm not really out there. You know, I have my martial arts academy, Machado, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy. But I kind of look at Yellow Pages, like we post stuff and whatnot, but like I'm not trying to really attract a following. I'm trying to get people through the front door. And then in my security business, like I just have all the right clients and had them for a long time. I'm not really out there on Facebook. I have a LinkedIn, but like I'm not active with it. I use it more as like a business card. You know, I'm in business to provide goods and services. And I kind of think, and like I'm not trying to be offensive, but a lot of people in the security industry that have a lot of time to be online and forums and whatnot, they probably don't have a lot of work. I'm like working like every day. I don't have time to take care of that garden, you know, because like social media, like you have to be pretty active on there, but you know, we're pretty busy with work. But that said, you know, there's this saying Musashi has about, and I'll read the paragraph and then I'll say like what I thought. If you look at the world and see arts for sale, men use equipment to sell their own wares and selves. As with the nut and the flower, the nut has become less than the flower. in this kind of way of strategy, both the teaching and those learning the way are connected with the coloring and showing off of technique, trying to hasten the bloom of the flower. They speak of this dojo and that dojo. They are looking for profit. Someone once said, immature strategy causes grief. That was a true saying. And this is the words of Masashi. And what I pose to you, Joe, is the state of social media. Some of it can be very shallow on the martial arts end or the security end of things. What would Masashi think of social media today? What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I think he's kind of, Masashi's kind of the guy, I think he probably would have seen it as an opportunity initially, and then probably decided that he needed to just employ someone to do it for him, to take advantage of it without distracting himself with it. I think that's probably, if I'm being honest, I mean, that's why, I mean, the companies that are busy and still have a social media profile, normally it's because they've employed people to just do the social media, because they're busy operating. But it is an interesting thing. There's so many bits and pieces on that about the showing off of wares and I think social media in general, I don't think it's just social media. I think it's a whole bunch of societal trends have shortened the attention span so much that now to sell martial arts, you have to stand out against this deluge of information and different options and different TikToks and different short clips of fancy stuff. And whereas, like, I know when I was a kid going to martial arts classes, like, my options were the three that were within driving distance of my house. That was it. There was no like, oh, I need to Google the lineage of this instructor, or I need to watch their demonstration, or it's like, no, it's just like my parents would say, here's three we can get to. This is the cheapest one. This is the one we want you to go to. Unless there was something glaringly wrong with that dojo, that's probably the one I went to.
That's how I ended up in
a much different world.
Yeah. That's how I ended up in judo. I wanted to do karate. I was a huge Bruce Lee fan. My parents were like, you're going to judo at the YMCA. And how smart were they later on? I learn. I think like when the internet first came out, this is before the social media of the internet and apps and smartphones, people would say that you could use the internet for good or for bad things. And I think kind of social media is the same way. It's a great reference point. It's a great way to reinforce points. But the internet can't become, like in martial arts, it can't become your sensei, right? You have to, I'll give you a good example from jiu-jitsu. So John Jock Machado had a seminar a couple weeks ago, and he brought in some guys he came up in the 80s and 70s with in Brazil. And these guys, man, it was amazing, man. And they all have their own academies in Brazil now. And they, you know, and some of them are here in the United States, but these were guys like at point zero for jiu-jitsu, with all the, Hickson the whole Gracie clan and the Machados, for those that don't know, are the cousins of the Gracies that all came up together in jiu-jitsu. And so I was going to be the smart guy. I was like, hey, what are you guys doing after the seminar with John Jock? And they were like, oh, we don't know. I was like, hey, let's go to Morton's and have a steak, right? So Morton's a high-end steakhouse. I don't know if you have it in Australia, but it's a high-end steakhouse. And these guys like jumped on it. So I got it. I was being selfish. I wanted to pick their brains on the history of jiu-jitsu. And I asked them what they thought about, and part of my question about what they thought about like apps and short things like TikTok and Instagram. And I thought their response was interesting because you could apply it to a lot of situations. So they said that it was a scourge basically, because they would have students come into class trying to do a flying armbar or something crazy. And they would point out to the student in the beginning, they don't understand defense, right? And so in the Machado system, it's very important to develop good defensive skills and good subjugation skills and basics to control and hold a person, and then the submissions will open up, right? And that's what really makes high-end grappling and jiu-jitsu in particular work, is that you're really developing the granular of how to hold somebody down and let them move this way or that way. And so I thought that was really interesting, because I often tell my own students, like, hey, you're not going to learn from a book, and now it's you're not going to learn from the internet or an app. Although it's a good reference point, it's not all bad, but the internet can't be your sensei. And so I think with a lot of that too, like the internet or autodidact type learning, it's good, but at some point, like, you know, it's like you got to go back to school, or you got to get a certificate, or you should probably pursue higher education. Or once you do that, I know you had mentioned that you went back to school pursue a security advanced degree, a master's degree. I did the same thing before I retired from policing. And, you know, it didn't happen. I didn't finish college and then start a master's degree. I got a lot of work and experience in between that. Social media and apps in particular, with 4-second attention spans, are probably cool to watch. But what's dastardly is that there's so many people that take advantage of that situation. I'm going to be the next guy that spins on my head and hits an arm bar and whatnot. None of that's practical. And that goes back to what Musashi is saying. They talk about this dojo and that dojo. And this is not, like, I've been reading this passage for years and years and years. And it's always one of the passages that has resonated to me, because you should be studying things that are going to make you safe rather than the flowery, crazy things that look cool but are not going to keep you safe.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thing, isn't it? I've had over the years probably, I don't know, hundreds of people that have said, oh, can you interview this person, or can you talk to my sensei, or can you do like whatever the connection is. But so someone, and sometimes it's the flavor of the month on social media, is someone who's posting some really tightly edited clips that look really cool, and like, I'm happy to talk to anyone, but if I can tell there's no substance there, then I don't know what I'm going to talk to them about for an hour, other than video editing techniques and their social media marketing, which is probably not really the thing my listenership wants to talk to. I will say, though, one thing I'm very grateful for social media for, other than obviously having my podcast, but one of the things I'm very grateful for is when we're doing investigations in OSINT, the amount of information that people put out there makes that so much easier. The ability to do an investigation with someone who uses social media with no privacy settings, it's just like it's
and
it's,
they do
it's
it all easy. The time. They do it all the time. Right before I sat down to do this, that's exactly what we were doing on a threat, working a stalker case. Let me kind of speed ahead here, because I got a lot of material,
sure.
We're not going to get to it today. But this will resonate to our group, and I think, you know, we're going to skip forward to the water book, which is the next chapter.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that resonates with the Book of Five Rings, from martial artists to business practitioners, and if you look at this is what's crazy. This is a old, almost like early 80s, 1970s copy that you see around. And this is what dates it. It says, a Book of Five Rings, the classical guide to strategy. And then it says, Japan's answer to the Harvard MBA. And then Time Magazine comments. And this is more an issue of the book that was directed on the back. It says, like, business martial arts. It says, on Wall Street, when Musashi talks, people listen. Do you remember that? When E.F. Hutton or whatever, or like, that used to be a saying in the 80s, like, when so-and-so, I think it was E.F. Hutton talks, people listen. And, you know, I mean, that just goes to show, like, you know, this is like a 1980s version of this. And so Musashi resonates to a lot of people. And this is to say that Musashi is a legend. He's a duelist, undefeated samurai. And this section, the water section, lays out technical abilities, not just theory. But what resonates to people is that these techniques were all battle tested. And then on the end, he puts on like what you have to do. So, you know, there's things in here that are, you know, here's your stance, gaze and strategy, holding a long sword, 5 attitudes and whatnot. These are all technical advisements. But at the end, he gets down to some grit that is timeless. And in that, here's the practical. He says, study the contents of this book, taking one item at a time. And though fighting with enemies, you'll gradually come to know the principles of the way, step by step. So Musashi says, even a path of 1,000 miles is walked one step at a time. Then he adds, practice steadily, remembering that your duty, this is the duty of the warrior. Thinking today, I will defeat who I was yesterday. And tomorrow, I will defeat the less skillful. And after that, I will defeat the more skillful. And here's the final thing, the final, and we've all heard this if you've studied Musashi and you've heard a different form of it. Forge yourself with 1,000 days of training and polish yourself with 10,000 days of practice. I did the math on that in prepping this. So 10,000 days comes out to 27 years, 0.397. And, you know, we talk about 10,000 hours, right? That was the, you know, investing 10,000 hours. And so like a couple times I looked at like, how much time have I spent in martial arts? 45-year martial artist. How many times did I spend in policing and government, military profession? So I got about like, you know, 34, 35 years between those two entities. And, you know, there was... still to this day, there's a lot for me to learn, even though I have that basis. But I know, for instance, I went and testified as an expert witness last week and in a security case. And, you know, no one else knew. Like, you know, like I was like, this is what the state law says. This is the training that you would receive. You know, this is the process. And even from the lawyers to the judge, it was very obvious that I was the most knowledgeable person in the room. And communicating to a jury like a message of what we wanted them to understand as evidence. And that's what Musashi's talking about here. Step by step, practice steadily, and then forge yourself through training. How is that not only important in martial arts training, but also important for the total development of a human being, a holistic. And I know you talk a lot about that on with various guests and whatnot. It's just, you know, it's about becoming a total person.
100%. And I think the word forge is very interesting, right? Because a forge isn't a peaceful experience. Like if you're being forged, you're going through fire. Right? And I think... one of the things we get way too comfortable with is going through the motions in our training. And I think if the training isn't challenging you, it's not making you grow. And I think there's a time and place for quiet repetition and doing your meditative kata or whatever it is that makes you whole. But if you're trying to grow in your practice, I think it doesn't have to be like, not every session has to be a death session where you feel like you're not going to be able to walk for the rest of the day. Like it just has to push you just a little bit more, just to do a little bit more and to try something a little bit of a different way or trying that technique you're not very good at and getting in 50 reps of a technique you don't like. Like those kinds of things, I think, or changing the scenario like we talked about before. I've done this 1,000 times in my mind's eye while I'm on my own, but how's it change if I've got this variable or that variable? And even just the mental blueprinting to put yourself in uncomfortable situations, worst case scenario situations, and thinking through how you're going to get out of that. For me, even just when we talk about study, like I've gone back to do a master's degree, and part of those some of those subjects are things that I'm not very good at. I don't like doing them, but I have to do them because the fact that I don't want to do them means I probably should be doing them. The ones I want to do are the ones I'm already good at. So I think it's really important that we take that attitude towards all things, not just our martial arts training.
Right. And it's important to work at the things that we're not good at. So like, although I'm a college graduate and have an advanced master's degree, it wasn't easy for me. And I'll tell you, honestly, like, I'm so glad we're talking about Musashi, because as a as an ideal, like as an archetype of a warrior, is that like I was like, hey, I'm good at all the tactical stuff, but you have to have the pen and the sword. And that kept me going to school. The Book of Five Rings, the Musashi experience, and, you know, like, I wanted to be a scholar warrior. But I'll tell you this, Joe, I'll be honest with you. So I was in a 2-year master security management program through John Jay College, which is a New York online master's degree. But John Jay is a famous criminal justice, totally devoted criminal justice university, lots of cops and whatnot. I've been there in New York twice. They have a 9/11 memorial in there. It's an incredible, right next to Central Park, but a credible facility. 2 years for me, because I was working the streets, took, taking a class at a time, 3 years and 3 months. And by the time I was done, I was told everyone I have academic PTSD, and I'd rather get down in a gunfight with some bank robbers than do 3 years and 3 months in school again. But of course, learning my lesson, I enrolled in a PhD in criminal justice. So it's a lot of stuff that I know, and I'm chipping away at it, but that's a very long process. But I'm continuing to say, it's just not enough to be, have the phenomenal police experience that I had and have a great martial arts academy. Nope, you have to be the pen and the sword. And so I'm trying to strive to that ideal. You know what? I know you're talking to somebody on your podcast used the term martial archetypes. Do you remember that? The ideal, not martial arts, but martial archetypes. I think it was discussing the Sherlock Holmes martial arts, Baritsu. Does that ring a bell?
Baritsu. Yeah. We'll be talking to Tommy Joe Moore.
Oh yeah, incredible, super smart guy, and there's one app, the hat maker, right? The guy wrote for Black Belt, wrote all those books.
Yep.
Man, you just have so many people. And, I think if you had them there, they would tell you that Musashi, the Book of Five Rings, was a huge influence and a text that they come back to. So, book, it's phenomenal, man. There's a lot of stuff. I have so many notes. We're not even going to get to it all today.
We need to do a part 2 and 3 on this. We literally talked about Ground Book, a little bit on Water Book. We've still got Fire, Wind, and Void. But one of the things I love about this book, and probably just as a closing comment on this particular episode, was that one thing I love about this book, as you said right at the beginning about the movie Colors, that this is a book that I read as a teenager, and then I read it again a few years later, and I've read it again many times ever since then. And every time it hits me a little bit different. There's something that I thought that I took for granted the first time that didn't stand out. And there's been several books like that. Art of War, Book of Five Rings, even Tao Jeet Kune Do has had the same. Initially, I just want to see the cool diagrams and the techniques, right? And then you start looking a bit deeper. And there are books that I remember reading it early on where I'm like, yeah. And then 5 or 6 years will go by, I'm like, I've already read that. I don't need to read it again. I already absorbed everything. I'm advanced now. I have to read other things. And you go back and read it, you're like, oh, there's so much I missed. That was buried.
Unfettered mind, the life-giving sword. I mean, when you get into these classic texts, there's so many subtexts to them that you could literally, become immersed in reading ancient books from Japan, and also too, historical European historical martial arts. I mean, they've done a great job outlining warrior codes and whatnot. The final thing I want to say, I know we're going to cut out here, is that Musashi, he systemized things. So if we go back to, I think it's in, going back to the Ground Book. He was prescriptive. And so a lot of this ended up in Dakota later, which was his final work of the 21 precepts, The Way of Walking Alone. But you can see that here in the Book of Five Rings. And he says, do not think dishonestly, right? The way is in training. Become acquainted with every art. Know the ways of all professions. Distinguish between gains and losses in worldly matters. Develop intuitive judgment and understanding for everything. Perceive those things which cannot be seen. Pay attention to even trifles. Do nothing which is of no use. And, you know, each one of those you could spend like 20 minutes talking about or thinking about, right? But Musashi was taking a holistic approach to training people and writing this text prescriptively. And he just didn't give you some technical things, and he didn't give you just some philosophical things. He gave you a combination of both. And, you know, like you said, 400 days later, we're still pondering what he said. And it's really great stuff. It is really, really great stuff.
You know, it's not on camera, but I have a poster right in front of me that I had printed out that actually has that quote, "Do nothing that is of no use." And it's like, it's a constant reminder to me, whether it's procrastinating on things, whether it's spending time scrolling through different social media feeds that have no purpose. It's a constant sort of encouragement and chastisement for myself to do nothing that is of no use. And I think it's really powerful.
So we're bringing Musashi to the modern. One of my greatest inspirations in the modern time, as I walk into this corporate building, one of my clients, been my clients for a very long time, in a wood paneled executive boardroom, right up in gold letters, it says, "Exceed expectations," right? That's like their corporate motto. And I think when we're saying, do nothing that's not of use, right? Exceed expectations in the modern corporate world is we're refining what we're doing and we're getting the job done. And I think that's like what resonates out of these books is like, we can stay with them as historical tools, but the reality is we have to take what the ancients have told us and be able to interject that into a modern society, which, you know, is probably much different, you know, in the way we earn our living and whatnot. But someone once told me, and I'll close with this, is that within the span of 3 feet in a bookshelf, you can learn pretty much everything about the world. And we need to, as human beings, read. I went to a very special dinner during COVID with the Marine Corps General, Jim Mattis. But once he was talking, and so they sat him down at a table with me and another guy, and I had dinner with him. And he said, "Mark, people that don't read are functionally illiterate. That, you know, it's not a matter of if you read or not, you need to read because you will be functionally illiterate." And let me say, man, Mattis, man, that was a great experience to sit down and talk to him, man, because he was a warrior. You know what they call him? The warrior monk. You know, this guy, yeah. The first time I saw him, we were doing a protection detail about right before COVID. And they were like, "Hey, there's some State Department guys over there." So I went over and they were like, "Yeah, we're here on a EP detail." I said, "Hey, we're like a police group. We're doing this tree lighting ceremony, counterterrorism, you know, static here." And they were like, "Oh, okay, well, it's James Mattis. He's in here. He went and met his friend here for dinner." And we said, "Hey, could we wait for him to come out?" So he comes out, he's carrying a stack of books. Like, he carries books with him everywhere. And then my acquaintance, Rodney, came out, and I was like, "He's here meeting." I didn't even know he like knew Mattis. And so they had formed this friendship, and we got to talk to Mattis. And then about a year later, I got invited to this dinner in COVID, and it was amazing. They had a bunch of Navy SEALs there, congressional Medal of Honor recipient there, who was shot 21 times in a rescue in Vietnam. They had the head of SEAL operations there, the vice admiral of the Navy was there. I mean, there was like I was like, "What am I doing here?" But it was an awesome experience. And I promise you I'll get a hold of Mattis and get him on your podcast.
Oh, that'd be an absolute treat. Awesome. Mark, we need to close out here, but look, Mark Morales, he's the principal of Critical Solutions Protective Services Group, absolute friend of the show and a warrior scholar. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge. And I think we've just kept the door open. We've got to have to do a part two, possibly three of this, because we're incapable of talking about Musashi in 45 minutes. So we'll make sure we reconvene down the road and do the rest of the book and probably some more other stuff as well. excuse me, I got through the entire podcast without coughing and then right at the end. Thank you very much, Mark, and I wish you and your family and all your team a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll talk again
soon. Merry Christmas to you.
You've been listening to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Make sure you check out our catalogue at www.violencepod.com for more interviews with the world's leading experts in violence prevention, threat assessment, and personal security. If you'd like to support the work I do on the show, please visit www.violencepod.com/support. And if you're interested in booking me or my team to provide training, workshops, or consultation on violence prevention and management, you can visit violencepod.com/training. I look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Until then, stay safe and stay dangerous. Yeah.